Accession number 28354, Reel 22.
You were telling me that Ark Royal had had a collision with a Soviet destroyer.
All I could tell this liaison officer was that I'm going to my hotel and I'm going to go to sleep. There's absolutely nothing I can do about it, and I'm sure the captain of Ark Royal is managing all right. He was. Every carrier, everywhere, and for some years, my time in Hermes, it applied equally. The Russian snooping trawlers or destroyers would follow you around continuously while you were operating aircraft. And this case, it was a destroyer, and it misjudged crossing Ark Royal's bow, and Ray Ligo, the captain, struck it. No great damage, I don't think, to either ship, it all passed off without too much of a serious political incident. It was something that was going to happen. I'd seen some fairly close ones when I was in Hermes, not when I was captain of Hermes, but when I was Flag Ostrakov carriers in Hermes. We were off Lossiemouth. The ship there monitoring us came dangerously close all the time. So that was yes. Soviet activity was considerable. They did actually do the biggest Atlantic exercise of any time. At one time when I was commander in chief, I don't remember the exact date of it, but it was sufficiently large and different to any other exercise that we'd seen of the Russian Navy in the Atlantic. I went out in a pretty useless thing to do, actually. I went out in a Nimrod aircraft of the RAF in order to observe them. It was very, very interesting because when we got there was one of the biggest gales in the Atlantic you ever saw, and the entire Russian fleet was hove to. So it wasn't very difficult to observe them, but it certainly wasn't possible to observe what they were doing, because they were doing absolutely damn all. Nobody would be able to in that weather. But we took a lot of good photographs, and one of those things you do as commander-in-chief, you think presumably that you're doing something useful. You weren't. You were probably getting in the way, because there's nothing you could do, but it was interesting to go and see it. I flew up to Iceland to see my subordinate commander there. That was an American rear admiral. Of course, Iceland's real use was for maritime aircraft. The airfield there being important, strategically placed in the Atlantic. The American admiral, I remember, amused us very much because he had a welcome mat saying "welcome" on his doorstep, and his lavatory was one of the old-fashioned, you know, pull the plug with a cistern up in the air ones, and the whole thing was wreathed in artificial vines. I always remember this camouflage in the lavatory.
What was the extent of Soviet submarine activity, which presumably you had to monitor?
Well, yes. We weren't really monitoring. I mean, Soviet submarine activity was monitored more by let me think. Obviously, there was a certain amount of submarine observation going on in the Arctic of our submarines following Russian submarines. I wasn't really briefing on that, though. That would have been done straight from intelligence down to HMS Dolphin and Flag Officer submarines. Didn't really come through my headquarters. I was, of course, I did command the submarines, yes, and as far as fleet work was concerned, but I don't think I was ever personally involved in any planning of any supervision. I was involved in planning of Polaris submarines because they came under my command. I was commander Task Force 317, or whatever number it was, and commanded the Polaris submarines direct, and I had a separate little headquarters at Northwood, which was the Polaris headquarters, obviously a very high security place. One thing that did interest me during our time there, and I always thought it was curious, that the chap that had his finger on the trigger was me, so to speak, my organisation anyway. And I had a direct communication line with Downing Street, through, down to Polaris headquarters. But neither Prime Minister, while I was there, as far as I know, had the remotest idea who the hell I was. And I thought that if I was Prime Minister, and this was one of the most vital things at that time that I had, I'd like to know the bloke that was managing it, so to speak, that was responsible for that it tipped and that the submarines were at sea, which was ultimately me. And they never did. I never met Mr. Wilson. I never met Mr. Heath as Commander-in-Chief, the Major Commander-in-Chief of the fleet. I always thought this is odd, and that they should at some time have said, come and see me, I'd like to know who you are. I don't know whether that applied always, whether my predecessor and successor had that experience. Everything's changed so much that the many subplots that were going on at that time within NATO are no longer really very interesting. I mean, one of the subplots was that the Americans were trying to build up the Lisbon headquarters, which was an American rear admiral, and I was trying to cut down the Lisbon headquarters because I thought it was a total waste of time. It was a silly command between me and Gibraltar. And I had Plymouth and I had Gibraltar, and I didn't want anything in between in my NATO hat. However, the Americans wanted to build up there was a political side to this. They wanted to build the Portuguese up and make them feel important in NATO. I understood it, but operationally, I thought it was a great waste of money.
Was this a policy decision that you took, or one you inherited?
Quite a small command I inherited, right. And the Americans were building it up to a bigger one.
Yes.
As hard as they could go.
Yes.
Which, of course, was within my within my Eastern Atlantic command as a NATO head.
Yes.
Was in Sackland's command.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that went on all the time, and it was built up to something much bigger. Eventually. I think I'm really drying up, you know.
Well, if you have... I know that you have mentioned in your book, in your memoirs, a reference to... a disagreement that you had, I think, with Peter Hill North.
Oh, this was HMS Eagle, and I have got it written down here. I was going to talk about it. Ian Robertson, Captain Robertson, brought HMS Eagle into Plymouth Harbour and hit the ground. Not very seriously, but he did hit the ground and had a certain amount of damage to the ship. This was a repetition, actually, of Admiral Gibson. Donald Gibson, I already mentioned, he also took HMS Eagle. No, he took Ark Royal in once and hit the ground in almost exactly the same place. They turned the corner slightly too less sharply than they should have done. So there was a court-martial of Ian Robertson for hazarding his ship, and the court-martial reprimanded him. That's all. It didn't seriously reprimand him, just reprimanded him. The First Sea Lord, Admiral Peter Hill Norton, reckoned that I ought to relieve him. I ought to relieve Ian Robertson of his command. I reckoned that as I had appointed a court-martial, and as the court-martial had found merely reprimanded Robertson, that he should stay in command. And I was called to London, and the First Sea Lord sat one side of... with the Second Sea Lord... one side of the table, and I sat the other side, and these two men tried to persuade me to sack Ian Robertson from his command. I wasn't going to, because I was absolutely certain that he should stay, and that this was unfortunate. He touched the ground, but he should stay in command, and that the punishment of reprimand was the one properly awarded. And what was such fun about this is that I knew that I would win this argument, because if the First Sea Lord sacked the Commander-in-Chief, sacked the captain of the ship over my head, I would have... we didn't get to discussing it like this. He knew perfectly well that I would have resigned, or asked to be relieved or whatever, and that this would have looked a bit stupid. So we had the most enormous battle, one of those most enjoyable arguments, because I knew I was going to win, notwithstanding the pressure of these two eminent gunnery officers to persuade me to relieve Ian Robertson. Anyway, I didn't relieve him. He stayed in command. He was promoted to Rear Admiral. Only one job, but he was quite a good Rear Admiral. And I think I was justified. That was the only... And that was a major disagreement with my First Sea Lord. We had others at that time. In particular, I mean, the particular disagreement was over the air command of the North Atlantic. I'm sure he was for appeasing, so to speak, Spotswood and letting him in as a commander-in-chief, and I was against it. We didn't agree on that one. I didn't think I was supported properly by my First Sea Lord in that particular argument. I felt let down, so to speak, to a degree. That's that one.
What were your... I mean, Peter Hill Norton's quite a famous figure in the Navy, and of course he has, this time last year, he completed his contribution to the Sound Archive. What were your impressions of him? Because you must have seen something.
Yes.
You must have come across him several times.
I've known him all my career, in fact, off and on. Obviously, he was rather senior to me at Dartmouth. Well, not all my career. The first time I met him... and got to know him a bit better was when he was captain of HMS Decoy? No. Anyway, one of the Darings. This is when I was chief of staff to Admiral Holland Martin as flag officer for Scylla's Mediterranean. There were three captains in three Darings, and I call them the three prima donnas. They didn't have any... they didn't have a Captain D. They were individual commands. So when they came to see... during the Suez operation, they came under my admiral's command. When they came to see me, they came as a trio, with a chap called Nigel Austin as a sort of primus inter pares, as the senior of the three, and were awfully difficult to deal with. I must say they were much more senior to me, and they were in this funny independent command, with no boss over them, so to speak. I met Heal Norton then. And sadly, my wife and I have never forgiven him for almost the first meeting there, where we were having dinner in HMS Decoy, I can't remember the name of the ship, anyway, Nigel Austin's Daring. And throughout the whole dinner, Peter Hill Norton, having met my wife never before, throughout the whole dinner, he used foul language all the time. She never forgave him that. She thought it was so discourteous and so rude that nothing he could do or say to her after that would made my wife any more friendly towards him. She disliked him intensely, but it started at that moment. And that was the sort of thing he was, I'm afraid, a man who disregarded other people's feelings very thoughtlessly, and was... This is me, this is my way, take me as I am. That was the sort of attitude. And it wasn't an awfully nice I am, not to us anyway. Though when he was Commander-in-Chief in the Far East, and I was, when you leave Michael Carver, I got on professionally perfectly well with him there. My wife again didn't get on very well. I think she, as the senior... service commander's wife, she always found herself sitting next to the commander-in-chief at official dinners, and she found him awfully boring. She didn't worry about his language then, because it didn't come out so much, but she found his conversation so boring. My wife didn't warm to that man at all, nor did I. Though when I met him, I could talk with Peter Hill Norton in a perfectly ordinary, friendly fashion, and I quite enjoyed conversation with him very often. But it was I think he was a very egocentric person. So he's dead now, but he just wasn't an attractive man. I remember him sacking his ADC, who was a Royal Marines officer in Singapore, and we'd rather liked this chap, and Rita, you know, expressed disappointment that he'd gone, and Peter Lorne said, well, I'm not going to change, I'm how I am. He had to change, he didn't change, so he's gone. Fair enough, I suppose, but it's always slightly brutal, and this was quite an able, I think, Royal Marines officer. So I don't know whether Peter... No, I think that's really... I don't know whether he knew what we felt about him. I don't think he cared what people felt about him, truly.
Good. Well, thank you for that. We come then to the end of your time, and I think there are one or two vignettes relating to your departure from your job, and which are mentioned in your biography, and that at very short notice, Peter Hill Norton, who has become first CDS, is bumped up to CDS, and then there is a discussion as to who is going to take his place.
Yeah, this was great. When Admiral Leffenhew died, obviously things changed, and well, good, go on. When Admiral Leffenhew died, I was with various people, and we'd gone to some meeting, I suppose, in the Admiralty. I was with Michael Pollock in St. James's Park, I remember. We walked across St. James's Park. And Michael Pollock said to me, if you become First Sea Lord, Bill, I'll be very happy to serve under you. Now, that was a very nice, generous thing to say. It took me completely by surprise, truly, because I hadn't conceived for one minute that I might be First Sea Lord. And I've always regretted ever since that I didn't give the reply I should do, and if you're First Sea Lord, Michael, same applies with me. And that, of course, is what actually happened. He did become First Sea Lord. But it hadn't crossed my mind. Then I was sent for by Peter Hill Norton and told, he said that it was either you or Michael Pollock, and I have chosen Michael Pollock. And I remember saying to him, that's fair enough. I said, I think you've probably made the right choice. But then he said, and you will be relieved by Edward Ashmore in July, I think it was, in 1971. And retire. And this upset me very much because I'd hoped I'd do 2 years as Commander-in-Chief, and this was fairly much short of it. This was very much short of it. It was only just over a year. And having been a naval secretary myself, I thought this was a bit inconsiderate. And when I got back to my office, I thought it was extremely inconsiderate, because I would be several months short of my 55th birthday, and if I served until my 55th birthday, then I would get a full admiral's pension. There was quite big deductions if you reduced it, and over the years, and I've lived quite a few years since then, it would have been paid a huge sum of money. So I wrote to him, to Peter Hill Norton, suggesting that he might adjust it so that I could at least serve until my 55th birthday, but he refused. And so that was it. I was going to be relieved in June or July. Michael Pollock then became First Sea Lord, and I immediately wrote or went to see Michael Pollock and explained this to me, and he immediately adjusted the Admiral's plot so that Edward Ashmore relieved me that much later, and I was still on the active list on my 55th birthday. There was no problem about doing it. And I was upset about this, apart from being personally upset that it was inconsiderate to me, that any First Sea Lord, or sorry, I was upset that any naval secretary should allow the First Sea Lord to do it. Because as soon as the First Sea Lord had said, I'm going to chuck O'Brien out in July, the Naval Secretary should have been in and saying, but sir, you mustn't, because here's the facts, and here's his pension, and this will mean something to him. That didn't happen. So I couldn't see myself as having been naval secretary, letting David Luce do that to somebody, for example. There we are. And but it all worked out in the end. That was, I suppose that's another example of my feeling that Admiral Hill-Vaughton wasn't always as considerate a man as he might have been. I don't know, were there any other things for my turning over? Oh yeah, I wrote a hold-down report like everybody does. And in the hold-down report I had certain criticisms about weaponry and training of weaponry in the Navy. Nothing very serious, it wasn't. It was criticism. This is a confidential document, of course. And I was very surprised, therefore, in retirement, to be rung up by Chapman Pincher, saying all sorts of things that I'd said them, that I'd been very critical of the Navy, the Admiralty, the First Sea Lord, or whatever. Can't remember what his words were. And pretending, Chapman Pincher was, that he'd got this from some inside source, but I knew from what he was saying that he'd actually read the paper. It was perfectly clear he'd read it, he'd got it in front of him. I said nothing to Pincher, I merely said, get on to the Admiralty. And rang them up and told them that this was happening. And it was quite interesting to see what Chapman Pincher published. And in my scrapbook, I've got what I actually wrote and what Chapman Pincher said I wrote. And it's wonderful what a gloss you can put on things. It's all very clever journalistic gloss, and you could almost believe I'd said the things he said I said. And I nearly said them, but not quite. That was quite interesting. My first experience of a leak. Actually, not quite my first experience of a leak. I'd had an experience of a leak before when I was captain of Hermes, and I wanted her to be twinned with some. Ships get twinned with towns and counties and things. Hermes was twinned with nowhere, and I wanted to get her twinned with some suitable twinning place, because it works very well for both the place that's twinned and for the ship itself to have an association. And somebody in the Admiralty, well, I wrote a letter to the Second Sea Lord asking how to go about this, couldn't he organise it for me, and that letter was leaked. And some headlines appeared in some tabloid newspaper of lonely sailors in HMS Hermes looking for pen friends. And that, of course, quashed the whole thing, because I couldn't then liaise with any village or town or whatever and be in debt to Nigel Dempster, it was. He's in the Daily Mail, isn't he? Something.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
I couldn't be in debt to Mr. Dempster for this twinning. So Hermes, in my time, was never twinned.
Did you discover who did leak the paper to Chapman Pincher?
No.
The first one?
No, I wasn't. I'd retired by then. Nor, I think, did the Admiralty. It wasn't a very important leak. I don't suppose they chased it too hard.
Notwithstanding a hold-down report is a confidential document, it's not too important.
I was upset it was leaked, but no, I never heard any more about it. Edward Ashmore, I think, made some little press notice something out to the press about what balls this was.
Yes.
And it died. It wasn't very important, is the truth of it. So, disappointing, the sort of bits of news you get. Early in my time as Commander-in-Chief, I was very worried that the size of the Russian naval threat simply wasn't appreciated, and I really felt that it ought to be more appreciated. And so when I was invited to address, as I was, the Grand Jamboree of the Wiltshire branches of the British Legion, and I came down to Corsham, I think it was, to do this, I wrote a speech on this subject of the threat from the Russian Navy and the lack of appreciation of it in the country. And I had the whole thing typed out, and I had distributed to every pressman could think of. And I spouted it from the rostrum, and there was absolutely not one report of it at all. That was really humiliating and brought me down to the ground properly. Healy had said there are no votes in defence, and there clearly weren't any as far as the press was concerned at that time, or any interest in it. This so it's rather a good speech, I thought. I'm very disappointed with that one.
So you come to the end of your time, your 55th birthday, you hand over to Edward Ashmore, and did you decide to go straight into retirement, or what did you do?
I went straight. I love gardening. I was going to dig my garden, and I was going to give myself 6 months anyway, doing that sort of thing. And also, I wanted to. I had my initial time planned. The Navy had never. I wanted to go and see my daughter in New Zealand. The Navy had never taken me to South Africa. Whenever I'd got near South Africa, it had said go the other way. Twice, in fact, I'd been on my way to South Africa and been turned back. So I arranged, the Barra Patrol was still going. As Commander-in-Chief, I arranged a tanker at a convenient time to be going to join the Barra Patrol, and my wife and I joined it at Rosyth, and we went to Cape Town in this vessel. And we then stayed with friends and obviously had a lovely time in South Africa. And I got the Navy to get me to South Africa, which it had failed so consistently to do during my career. And then I flew to New Zealand and saw my daughter and on to Hong Kong to see my son, where he was, and spent quite a bit of time doing that, obviously, to start with. I did look for a job. I didn't know what job I was looking for. Trouble was that I was going to live in my house. I was longing to live in my house.
Your own house?
Yes, I'd lived in so many other people's, and I'd never lived in my own.
Yes.
And this is so. That was in Wiltshire, that was in Devizes. The jobs for retired admirals around there weren't thick on the ground. And eventually, I saw the Kennet-Avon Canal, and I became chairman of that, and spent the next 17 years restoring the Kennet-Avon Canal. And then Mountbatten wrote to me and said I was just the only person possible and the most wonderful one and just the chap he was looking for to be chairman of King George's Fund for Sailors. And I fell for that bit of bullshit too. And for 12 years I was chairman of King George's Fund for Sailors. And I was president of the Association of Royal Navy Officers. And I found these are all charitable organisations, obviously including the canal, quite unpaid. I found these very satisfying and quite time-consuming and fulfilling. I thoroughly enjoyed the canal. That was running a big organisation, really, restoring 86 miles of canal and 104 derelict lots, etc., etc. That was a very interesting thing to have done, an enjoyable one. Much better, I think, than... And I lived in my own house.
And as a consequence of that, you never sought any... commercial activity in the conventional sense.
I did. I was on the list of, I can't remember what it is, business and executive somethings in the employment world for 6 months. Indeed, I drew my unemployment benefit for 6 months, and then my conscience stopped me. I threw that away and stopped looking. I stopped looking for a job when I found myself doing all these other unpaid ones.
Yes.
It was really General Sir Hughie Stockwell, who I took over the canal from, who said to me, you don't want a job, Bill. Your pension's quite good enough. You can live on that, as I am on mine. Enjoy it. And that's quite true. It was good enough.
I think we've come to the end, have we?
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I can't think of any more. I'll look at that dirty bit of paper here to see whether I missed anything I really wanted to. There's one chap I didn't talk about, that's General Andy Goodpaster, who was SACUR when I took over.
Oh, yes.
I think I just mentioned him because I really liked that man. I thought that was the most wonderful American. I was terribly upset for him when, I suppose it was it Nixon? Yes, it was Nixon, I think, who was president that time, when Nixon sacked him and replaced him with Al Haig. It wasn't perhaps that. I was upset because I thought he was a very good Supreme Commander and I liked the man so much. But he read it in the newspaper. And that. So I hated Al Haig and was almost disappointed when he was a very good Supreme Allied Commander, which I think he was. But I so liked good Pasta. Yes, that's a by the way.
Well, Sir William, thank you very much. This is quite timely. We're virtually at the end of this tape. Can I just say on behalf of the museum, thank you very much for your tremendous contribution over these many mornings.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I forgot to put the champagne on ice. I'd have a drink.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed.